You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everybody, welcome to MLB.com Extras, American League East. I'm Matthew Leach, and I'll be talking with MLB.com's five AL East beat reporters. It's an interesting race. It looked for a while like the Orioles might run away and hide. It's gotten a little bit closer. The Yankees are hot. The Blue Jays are still on the fringes. Time's getting a little tight on the Rays, and the Red Sox are definitely retooling for next year. But it's certainly not over, and I think you've certainly got three teams, maybe four, that still have some playoff hopes. So we'll be talking ball with five beat reporters. So we're getting ready to talk a little Baltimore Orioles with MLB.com's Orioles beat reporter, Brittany Ciroli. Pretty clearly, the biggest news around the club this week is the news of Manny Machado having surgery and being done. Was that a surprise for you at all, or did you kind of see that coming?
Yeah, it was. I think it was a surprise for the Orioles, too. They thought that he was making baby steps toward his recovery. It turned out that he was kind of not being entirely truthful in terms of how much progress he was making. He spoke to his doctor in L.A. and really approached the Orioles over the weekend and said, this is what I'm having done. So you could kind of sense that the Orioles weren't thrilled how the news reached out to Machado's doctor, and you know, the suddenness of this kind of news. But certainly when you look back and think about the fact, they didn't tell us what ligament was. They didn't tell us what grade the strain was. So you knew it was something a little more serious than they were letting on. But I would be lying if I said that I wasn't totally shocked that he was having season-ending knee surgery.
A little weird then in retrospect, the whole thing about him traveling with the team, that seemed to be that's generally the kind of thing that one doesn't do if one is a long way from being back.
Well, Matt Weiders does it, and he's out for the season. So it really wasn't all that weird for the Orioles.
They're obviously still kind of looking at what they want to do and how to figure this out, but Chris Davis has been playing third base a lot. Tell me kind of how that came to be and do you believe it's something that's going to continue?
Well, he played a ton of third with Texas. I don't think people realize he has probably some of the most games played at third base, comparatively speaking. So they wanted a way to get Steve Pierce, who's playing that real well, into the lineup regularly. Nelson Cruz, Nelson Young also hitting well. So having the three of them in the lineup requires Steve Pierce to be at first base. Now, Davis at third, they think defensively is a better option than Ryan Flaherty. At this point in time, they've really stuck with Jonathan Schoop staying at second for the most part. I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of change from that. With Chris Davis, they're going to keep running him out there. They need to find a way to get this guy right. I feel like he still presents a better option than what else they have at this point. So he's going to probably get the lion's share of the playing time the rest of the season there at third base. He's really improved. Even a lot of errors in the world first got him and put him at third base in the second half of the season. I believe in 2011 when they first made that trade from Texas, but his defense has gotten a lot better both at first and third. So that's what I would expect to see a lot of Chris Davis at third base over the next month.
He's improved, but he's still clearly not a really good third baseman, and it just stands out to me. It's something we've talked about before. I've asked you about, potential upgrades offensively at catcher or second base or whatever. Is there anything odd to you about the fact that the team that has been so adamant about we're not going to sacrifice defense is presumably to some extent sacrificing defense to get a guy who really isn't hitting into the lineup?
We really don't have any other option. It's not like they have someone on the bench who they're like, oh, this guy is definitely a huge upgrade over Chris Davis. There really isn't anybody. I don't know what you would do with this current lineup the way it's constructed, but I'd probably do the same thing that Buck's doing. Is Ryan Flaherty that much better than Chris Davis? Is Jonathan Schoop that much better at third base than Chris Davis? Like I said, there's not a whole lot of other options right now. So in terms of an upgrade, it's late August. Really hard to get a significant upgrade on a first-place team right now. This is the team that they have. This is the team that you're pretty much going to see throughout September, except for a few September call-ups. Joe Saunders is an on-roster guy I think they're probably going to add down the stretch. But down there, in terms of infield options, there's no one who's going to make an impact to really unseat Davis.
Well, you tell me. Is Flaherty really not significantly better defensively than Davis?
Not really, no. I think they're probably about the same, honestly. And Flaherty's been in a little bit of a platoon with Scope. I think they'd like to keep that. Flaherty's also a versatile guy, so having him on the bench, he can enter the game if there's an injury, second, short, third, whereas Chris Davis isn't nearly as versatile. And also, I think that they're probably about even defensively, and you have to hope that Chris Davis can break out. I mean, Ryan Flaherty can make the case, can't do any worse than Chris Davis, but Davis did have a home run last night. And you have to hope every game that it's a chance for Chris Davis to turn it around.
There was some conversation before the deadline among the various things that they might do about adding an infielder, even when Machado was healthy. There are a few days left, and there's obviously not a lot out there, but is there any talk of any kind of external move, even if not for a starter, of just somebody to add some extra options? Is that on the table at all, or is that really not an option?
Not really. There's really no one out there who makes a whole lot of sense. They were always looking pitching first at the trade deadline. I think people just threw in the infielder and catcher because in a perfect world, the Orioles would have liked an upgrade at the infielder and a catcher in terms of offensively. But it's not something that's been high on their priority list right now. They feel like they can keep pitching the way that they've been pitching, and the defense keeps playing the way that they have. More often than not, the offense wouldn't be able to scrape together enough runs. Nick Marquez is having a great year. Adam Jones is having a good year. J.J. Hardy seems to have turned it on as of late, so they feel like they can cover. And they've had most of the season now. They have a 6-game lead with this offense. And Manny Machado, minus that last month, really was either hurt or hadn't done anything. So this is essentially the club they have now. It's been the club that they've had for most of the year. Weeder's only played a month. So they think that they can win games, and they've won a lot of games the way they're constructed.
Well, one thing that is different these days is that Nelson Cruz is in a pretty serious skid. He was such a huge part of what they did early in the year. He is hitting for some power, but he's not getting really many base hits at all. What do you see going on with him?
Well, if you look over his career, he has a lot of injuries there, leg injuries in the second half, and Buck has DH'd him a lot, and I think that's because he's trying to avoid him burning out. I think there's probably some kind of situation with Nelson. He's DH'd much more than any of us thought, especially because Dylan Young is a little bit of a liability out there in the field, and he's the guy that's taking over. But I think with Cruz, you just got to get him healthy and get into the postseason because he's got a really good record in the postseason. He's shown he's a guy who really steps up to the bullpen. So in terms of worries, I think he's kind of towards the bottom of their list. The guy still has 33 or 34 home runs. He had a couple on the road trip. So I hope that he has some of the better at bats on this team, even if he strikes out or grounds out. It seems like he's working the count consistently. He's a really good veteran presence for them to have around some of those younger hitters. He's never been a first-inch half-set guy, so they like him. They feel like this was bound to happen. He wasn't going to hit the way he hit the first couple months of the season all year. Again, if they just get him healthy and get him in October, he could be a real force.
I saw something interesting looking around here. You know, It was a long relief appearance, but Ubaldo Jimenez's first relief appearance, at least from the box score, looked really good. Is he a potential weapon in the bullpen? Is he potentially something more than just a guy that you can't take off the roster, so he's got to be in the bullpen?
No, I don't think so. I don't think he's a guy that's made for the bullpen at all, honestly. That was more like a start. What the box score probably won't tell you is there's a 3-hour rain delay, so Ubaldo came out and it was basically like starting the game. It wasn't like he came in with runners on first and second or something like that. So he did pitch well. It took him 75 pitches, I think, to get through what he did. He still had a fairly high pitch count. I think he had one walk that Buck mentioned after the game. So they're just trying really to find some kind of use for him and not completely bury him, but he's going to be a mop-up guy. I don't think you pay a guy 4 years, $50 million to be in your bullpen. That bullpen is so good that you have to ask yourself, well, if you're going to keep Ubaldo in it for the postseason, which I don't see happening, who goes? So that relief corps, everyone in there, is really proven to have a role and have a spot. Those long guys, even McFarland and Brad Brock, their ERAs, when you look at them compared to some of the other AL long relief men, they pitch really well. So I don't think Ubaldo in the bullpen is anything they're thinking about long term. It's just a matter of getting through the next month with him, probably shutting him down, and seeing if he can come back fresh for training.
All right. Thanks, Brittany Giroli, for taking a few minutes to chat with us here. This is MLB.com Extras. We're going to be talking Yankees with Brian Hoke, who is MLB.com's Yankees beat reporter. First is the news. Sounds like things continue to sound good for Masahiro Tanaka. What's the status there?
Yeah, it's continuing as well as the Yankees could have hoped. He's continuing to throw off a mound. He's throwing simulated games, and if everything continues to go the way it is, soon he'll try and find a game for him, probably down in Florida. He'll be doing something. Still on track. They hope that he can make two or three starts by the end of September.
There was some worry. I mean, clubs are generally inclined to be, most of them, I think, are generally inclined to be optimistic when they talk injuries. But it seemed like there was some worry that they might not even get that. I mean, is this, if not ahead of schedule, at least sort of best possible timeline?
I think it's such an unpredictable injury. I mean, there's a long history of guys who have UCL tears, and it's more negative than positive. In the end, most of these guys, if not all of them, wind up having Tommy John surgery at some point. What worked in the Yankees' favor is they had three different doctors look at the tear. It was a small tear. They said it's smaller than 10%. That gave them hope that this was possible, that he could actually rehab it and get back on the mound and throw. I think that, you know, the jury's still out on this. You know, at any point he could snap off a splitter and it could go again. But as of right now, they seem to have repaired the damage. It seems to have healed, and he's throwing without pain. So until he actually reports any kind of discomfort, you just continue having him throw and cross your fingers and hope that he can come back.
In the absence of Tanaka and in the absence of a lot of other guys, really, they have gotten some terrific work from no-name, small-name pitchers of various stripes, reclamation projects. I mean, Brandon McCarthy's not a no-name, but reclamation project. Chris Capuano, a guy like Shane Green was really a borderline prospect. Is this Larry Rothschild's best work?
I think you have to say Larry's done a great job with what he's been given. They've definitely exceeded expectations, I think. If you told Joe Girardi in spring training that he was going to lose 80% of his opening day rotation and the only one left would be Hiroki Kuroda at the midpoint of the season, you know, they would have said, well, the season's not working out the way it is. But here you are. It's almost September. You've gotten one of those guys back in Michael Pineda, and, you know, that helps. And they're in position to make a run. You know, reeling off four in a row, that's what they have to do. They have to win the games that are ahead of them because not worry about what other teams are doing, because if they don't win their games, then there's really no point in scoreboard watching.
Is there anything else going on with the success they've had with, again, less than big-name pitchers? I mean, they have upgraded the defense. This still isn't a great defensive team. Is this some triumph of the scouting department? I mean, it just, you look at the names and you look at the numbers, and they don't really seem to agree.
Yeah, no, I think that some of these guys have exceeded expectations. I mean, you know, Brandon McCarthy is a guy who, I think if you look at him, you say he's a solid three or a four pitcher in a rotation. And what he's pitched like is a two at this point. I mean, he's been as good as anybody since he came to the Yankees. So I think he's exceeding expectations a little bit. I know that putting the cutter back in his repertoire helped him. It was something that the D-backs wanted to steer away from, and he kind of lost confidence in the pitch. And I think there's something to the mental aspect of that as well. I mean, you look at McCarthy's numbers in Arizona, and they were terrible. And no amount of pitching was going to reduce that. Well, the trade, you kind of reset your statistics, and he was able to do a full mental reset and come back and say, all right, whatever happened in Arizona doesn't count. Capuano was in a similar situation where he was with the Red Sox, got released. The Rockies were actually about to call him up. They were going to put him in the rotation, but then they swapped him to the Yankees and were able to get something out of him. Capuano is a borderline guy who, you know, obviously he had big league time earlier this year. He was pitching out of the bullpen, but to say that I'm less than surprised in how well he's pitched, I know he hasn't gotten a win, but he was in line for one yesterday. He's pitched much better than expectations.
On the less positive side of things, Mark Teixeira has two homers this month. He's drawing some walks, but really not doing much of anything else offensively. Is this just what happens at the end of a full season after a guy had a significant wrist injury, or what do you see going on with Teixeira?
I'm not sure if it's fatigue or what, but, yeah, I think the lack of power is alarming. The fact that he's just not having quality at-bats right now. And, you know, yes, you missed all of last year, and it's, but on the other hand, Derek Jeter did that too, and he's holding up pretty well. So I think that whatever's going on with Teixeira, obviously the Yankees need to figure that out sooner than later, because his real asset to the team is, you know, you're not looking at this guy to hit 280, 300 anymore. What you need from him is RBIs, home runs, you know, power production, extra base hits, and right now they're just not getting it out of him. So I think that there may be some health issues there. You know, I was talking to Jacoby Ellsbury yesterday, and he said, there's nobody in this clubhouse right now who isn't a little banged up at this point of the year. It's just you have to go out and play and strap it on. So, look, the Yankees are going to keep trotting Teixeira out there. He's their first baseman, but you really do hope that the bat comes around if you're the Yankees, because it's kind of a black hole in the middle of the lineup right now.
Is there anything resembling a plan B on the roster in the organization anywhere?
Not really. I mean, you know, you could, in theory, you could put Chase Headley over first. You've done that a little bit. They've played Cervelli at first base a little bit. You know, they tried Beltran there earlier this year, but who knows if he's even going to play the field at all anymore. You know, they have guys on the team. I mean, Zealous Wheeler, sure, but there's nobody who can equal what Mark Teixeira is supposed to be and can be for this team. And you know what? The power production was there earlier in the year. You just kind of hope it comes back.
Well, and that's what I wonder about. You know, there's missing a year with an injury, and there's missing a year with a wrist injury. I mean, it's just, do you see, just in watching him or in talking to people, indications that maybe that is, if not in a flaring up in the sense of an aggravation, just kind of that his end of the year is tougher than other people's end of the year because of what a wrist injury is to a hitter?
Well, this is an injury that Jose Bautista and David Ortiz both went through, and it's much more challenging, both of them said, to get back and get right. It usually takes a full year. So he's under a full year now. I think that, you know, he's given him what he can. He's made no secret about the fact that he's been banged up and that injuries are taking their toll on him, but he does want to be in the lineup. The Yankees right now have been treating it as though it's just a slump. If it's something more significant or severe, obviously they're not going to play him and risk losing him. So at this point, it's something the Yankees think he can play through. Sheriff says he can play through it, so they're going to keep trotting him out there.
He is under contract for two more years. Is there any way that he's not the first baseman for this club next year?
I can't see it. I don't know what you'd do with him, because you've got Alex Rodriguez coming back in theory, and he's going to have to DH. I mean, I guess you could play Alex at first base a little bit, but I would think they were going to want him to play third base more than first. No, I think that Teixeira's a guy, look, that money's spent. It's in there. He's on this team, and you know, they're not going to move him. Teixeira says he's got a no-trade clause. He wants to finish his year in New York, so I wouldn't look for that. I know that people have asked about it, but no, I think that Teixeira enjoys being a Yankee. He wants to be on this team, and he thinks he can produce for the team. And so, no, I would expect when the Yankees field their opening day lineup next year, Teixeira should be in there.
You mentioned some of the other guys that are dealing with various injuries, and it is a good point that you know, it's a baseball cliche, and nobody's 100% really after opening day. But what's the level of concern about, again, some pretty key lineup guys and an offense that can't really – do without him? I mean, there's some kind of issue with Gardner. There's maybe a minor issue with Ellsbury. Is there any of these situations where they're real worried, or are these all situations where it's, you figure in a few days maybe things get a little better?
It seems like right now everything's in the bumps and bruises category. And you know what? After they had that meeting against before the game against the Astros last week, they had a closed door meeting, and hitting coach Kevin Long talked a little bit. And a lot of the hitters were there, and things seem to have turned around. I mean, I know the first night they only put three runs, and we were saying, oh, you know, great meeting. But, you know, Brian McCann was saying yesterday that the at-bats up and down the lineup 1 through 9 have really improved over the last four games, and that's a positive sign. It makes you wonder why it took so long to turn around in the first place. But, you know, set your nose to the grindstone, go out there. I mean, I think part of it was facing the Astros and the White Sox, although Chris Sale is no cookie to go after. But the at-bats seem to have improved 1 through 9. You always look better when you're hitting and putting up runs and winning games than you did when you're not. So to have a 4-2 homestand, and, you know, even with those bumps and bruises up and down the lineup, I think that sends them off in this road trip in pretty good position. Now you have to see if the momentum can continue.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the thing, is that this lineup gets a nice test against the Tigers' rotation. What do you expect to see? Where do you expect to see this club when they get back home in a week?
Good question. Really good question. I mean, this is a big test. You know, obviously you've only got one game in Kansas City, but the showdown in Detroit is crucial. Toronto, it seems like they always put up a tough fight for this team. So, I mean, you have to go out there and you have to have a winning road trip. You really do. You have to win the games that you have to win. I mean, there's just no two ways around it. It's at the point of the schedule right now where if you don't win, you're going to be sitting home in October. So they need to go out and have a strong road trip. If they can win 4 out of 7, I think that would be huge for them. If you wind up going a 2-5 road trip, that's a lot more depressing, I think, for the Yankees. So you wait and see how it turns out. But, look, the team's playing better ball. There's no question about it. After those two losses to the Astros, you're ready to start shoveling dirt on them, and they came right back, and they keep making you say, well, wait, do the math again. Maybe there's a chance. So they have to keep winning those games and keep moving the percentages in the right direction.
Yep. Thanks, Brian Hoke, for taking a little time to chat here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Toronto Blue Jays with MLB.com's Blue Jays beat reporter, Gregor Chisholm. Gregor, this team's been up and down. We've talked about it a lot, but at this point, this is a pretty long funk. Jays, as we speak, are 6-15 in August, and the season's getting shorter. What's going on with this club?
It's the continued offensive woes for this team. I mean, you look at where they are right now. They've scored fewer runs than any other team in baseball this month, and it's just almost hard to believe that we're here, towards the end of August, talking about how the offense has been one of the main reasons why this team is falling out of contention for a spot in the postseason. I mean, offense was supposed to be a major strength from this team, and you still look at the overall numbers for the entire season. Their numbers aren't terrible, but a lot of that production came in the first half of the season. And since that, it's been a real struggle for those guys. I mean, just you look at the names in that lineup, even if they're missing a guy like Brett Lurie, there's no way this team with the talent on that roster should be sitting last in runs scored in the major leagues.
It doesn't help when the offense isn't hitting, obviously, but it also doesn't help when you do have a lead, you don't bring it home. You wrote recently, they're saying again that Casey Jansen is safe as the guy in the ninth inning. How long is that the case? How much of a rope does he have?
You know, I think they're going to give him every opportunity to pitch his way out of this. You know, he came in an interesting situation just talking with him earlier today, actually. During the All-Star break when the Blue Jays finished up in Tampa Bay, he took a short flight to the Dominican right after that and came up with a very severe case of food poisoning and lost about 10 pounds. And he's been kind of struggling to figure things out ever since. It took him a little while, kind of towards the beginning of August, before he was able to gain that weight back on. And he's just been still trying to figure things out. I mean, the velocity is never something that he's known for. It's pretty much been around where it normally is, but his command has been a little bit off, and that's been what's costing him lately. He's not the type of overpowering pitcher that can get away with some pitches, and when he's not commanding his fastball, it allows opposing teams to really sit on his secondary stuff, and that's what we've seen. I wouldn't be surprised if the Blue Jays kind of keep an eye on his workload. I mean, he's never a guy that really goes 3 days in a row anyways. He'll go back-to-back, and that's about it. But if he has some extended outings, I wouldn't be surprised to see the Blue Jays kind of sneak someone else in there, whether it's an Aaron Loop or maybe even an Aaron Sanchez to occasionally close things out. But I think Jansen has a very secure job in this team, and I wouldn't expect them to make a move, especially considering the fact that he's about to enter free agency and the amount of service time he's put on with this team. I think there's an amount of loyalty here within the organization for a guy like that.
You mentioned before with him, he's not conventional in some sense. And it's true, you don't have to throw 98. But you do need to miss bats. And his mm-hmm. strikeout rate is way down this year. Do you see a single cause for that?
Yeah, it's been one of the weird things to kind of figure out. You know, you would have thought that, you know, in the past couple of years, you would have seen him missing fewer bats just because the velocity over the past several years has just been on kind of an overall decline. But he's been able to make up for that by mixing speeds and really keeping hitters off in the off balance in the box. There's nothing really singular to point to this year. It's just been overall his command has been a little bit off. So the hitters have been able to kind of lay off on some of his trickier pitches. They're seeing the ball better this year from him. And overall, they're able to kind of sit on that and kind of drive. So, you know, it's something where he was getting away with that in the first half of the season, even though he wasn't missing very many bats. The overall, you know, just in terms of the ERA and the saves converted and everything like that was basically on par with what he's been doing. But when you see the lack of strikeouts in the first half, that does seem to be kind of trickling in now to the problems that he's had in the second half. It's kind of caught up to him a little bit.
Not to get too far ahead of things, because obviously this is a team that's still very much thinking about this year, but is that something that – is that an issue likely that they're going to have to deal with one way or the other in the offseason? I mean, do you figure he may be headed somewhere else come this winter?
It's going to be interesting from both sides on that perspective. I think Jansen, at least at one point, was very interested in coming to terms on an extension with this team and really kind of becoming part of the not only the present but the future as well in that closer's role. That's a little bit up in the air right now, and I think it's up in the air from both sides. You know, Jansen's been around this team for a very long time. You know, he's up there with Dustin McGowan in terms of the most tenured players on this team, and Dustin McGowan was absent for a number of years in that because of injuries. Jansen really is, you know, the guy who's been around this franchise for the longest out of anybody. And so he's kind of, I think there's a little bit of frustration in there about the lack of ability for this team to kind of take the next step. He's a guy from California. He likes the West Coast, but he also has a significant other from this area as well. So it's going to be an interesting choice for him. I think the Blue Jays would have interest in bringing him back, probably not on a deal that would be extremely long-term. I think he'd be looking at something very short-term for a guy like that. But I don't think there's any doubt that the Blue Jays would have interest in bringing him back. It's just whether or not Jansen has those same feelings or whether he thinks he would be better off kind of getting a start somewhere else.
It seems like overall, and not just the ninth, it seems like overall the bullpen has been an issue for a lot of this year, and maybe not a disaster, but an issue. That's the kind of thing that it can be fixed in season and has been fixed in season. Why do you think it is they didn't manage to fix that over the course of the year?
You know, what's interesting about that bullpen is that they've had so many options down there. I mean, that's, you know, relievers can be so hard to predict from one year to the next for whatever reason that is. And so we would have expected some down years from some guys down there. But you just looked at the guys that they had in spring training, whether it was Steve Delabarre, Brett Cecil, Aaron Loop, Dustin McGowan. I mean, they went like about 10 to 12 guys deep, and you figure, okay, well, if a few guys on this list struggle, everybody else would be able to come in and kind of help fill the void. It wasn't really the case early on this year, and it really wasn't until the Blue Jays added a guy like Aaron Sanchez to the bullpen where things really kind of started to be figured out a little bit. It gave them you know, a second kind of hard-throwing right-hander to combine with Dustin McGowan, and that's something that they really didn't have before because Sergio Santos struggled greatly in his role before he was sent down to the minor leagues, and the same thing could be said for Steve Delabarre. They were really missing that quality arm from the right side. Sanchez did come in here late in the season and help kind of figure things out with that, but his future is going to be in the starting rotation, so this is kind of a short-term fix for this year, and they're going to be back to the kind of the drawing board this offseason to try and find those right pieces to come together for next season.
One of the, you mentioned Sanchez, and there are a lot of interesting arms, but you know, the most interesting young arm on that club, obviously, is Marcus Stroman, and we've talked about him. I think we talked about him last week, but he's now had three rough ones out of four. Is this becoming any more of an area of concern for them as far as maybe whether he's wearing down some?
I think it has to be a concern. I think if that trend continues, it's going to be something that they're going to have to look at. As of right now, they're saying all the right things. Stroman saying he's not feeling fatigued at all, and the Blue Jays are saying that they have all the confidence in him that he's going to be able to kind of overturn that. I mean, this certainly could be fatigue. The other, the other scenario is that he just came in so effective earlier this year that he could just be, battling some inconsistency that a lot of young starting pitchers go through. I mean, there's opposing teams have made adjustments to him. There was a little bit of concern two starts ago that he was tipping some of his pitches, and so he's been working on that with pitching coach Pete Walker, just trying to refine those little things. I mean, these are all the tiny little things that you look for after going through a rough start and they're trying to figure out some cause. So they've been looking at some other things. As of right now, they say the fatigue isn't a concern, but I mean, if the trend continues, I mean, as we've talked about before, I mean, his innings, along with a guy like Drew Hutchinson, they throw more innings this year than they have before. So that's when you're talking about a young arm, you're going to want to protect them. And if the Blue Jays continue to fall in the standings, I wouldn't be surprised if at some point in September you either see the Blue Jays go with, bring up another prospect and go with a six-man rotation for a little bit to buy their guys more time, or simply take out a guy like Stroman or Hutchinson to kind of move forward and bring some new guys in just to make sure that they're not too tired before the end of the season.
It's a tough spot for them, isn't it? I mean, there's got to be some real win-now pressure. I mean, this is a general manager, a manager, an entire organization that really bet big on winning in the short term. Is there some real tension among the decision-making people there about how to balance these long-term assets with this short-term pressure to win?
Yeah, I think there really is. And, I think that's what's especially going to make this offseason very interesting as well, is that the Blue Jays are, kind of dealing with, a position player core that should be ready to win now. When you look at guys like Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion, Adam Lynn, all of those guys are kind of in their primes. And whereas the starting pitching, the things that are really going to carry this franchise forward are all the younger guys who their futures are ahead of them. In 2-3 years from now is when you can probably start to expect that they are at their best. But yeah, the pressure is on for this team right now, and that's why I think the last few weeks have been so depressing for this organization, for this team, because this is a team that, on June 6th had a 6.5-game lead on the American League East, and it seemed like a foregone conclusion that this team would be playing meaningful baseball in September. That's certainly no longer a guarantee, as they've really kind of continued to fall, and even though they're still technically within striking distance of that wild card, even more of a concern than the games back there are the number of teams that are in between them and that second wild card. It's going to be very, very, very difficult for that team to get back in the mix. And so but at the same time, they're going to hold on to that hope for as long as they possibly can. So when you're talking about possibly shutting down some of their young starters, that's certainly not going to happen, at least until, it becomes very obviously clear that they no longer have a shot at a spot in the postseason.
Gregor Chisholm, thanks for taking some time to chat on MLB.com Extras. Talking Tampa Bay Rays with MLB.com's Rays beat reporter, Bill Chastain. Bill, we've talked a lot about transactions and potential transactions, and one that did not come to fruition was a reported potential deal for Yunel Escobar. Was that close? Was that something you ever think was real, or was it just people kind of putting two and two together?
Well, it sounds like somebody spilled the beans that wasn't supposed to. In fact, Madden was upset yesterday that information did not remain confidential. Normally it's every team tries to get most of their players through waivers so they can trade them if they want to, or if something comes up, it just basically makes them liquid where they can move them. Of course, they're not going to comment whether or not they wanted to trade him, although they did reassure him that, they want to keep him. So, from an outsider looking in, it looks like it would have been a great move if they could have moved his salary based on how much longer they have with him. And some of the guys they got coming up who might be able to take his place. But, it was a little excitement at the first of the week.
Yeah, you mentioned that he is a guy who it might make some sense if they could find the right deal for, given a variety of factors. Do you think that that's something they'll explore over the winter, maybe check what the market is for Escobar this winter?
Well, it just depends if they're in a I would imagine, they're kind of always like every player on our roster is for sale, It's kind of like the consummate salesman. But I would definitely imagine that what they got him left at, that they will try and see if there's something out there to move him. I understand Nick Franklin can play some shortstop, and if worse comes to worse, maybe Zobrist goes back there, although there's good talk that Zobrist might move in the offseason too based on what he'll make next year. So I think it'll just depend on what they end up looking and seeing what their whole model is going to be next year, and whether or not they're going to move, try and reduce the payroll something. The payroll was up this year from where it's been.
One guy that presumably will be around next year, Will Myers is back, and the numbers look pretty decent, look like he's hitting the ball with some authority. How does he look to your eye? How's he swinging the bat from somebody who sees him up close?
Well, you know, the funny thing is he hasn't been swinging the bat. In fact, we were talking to him yesterday, and he'd had 15 at-bats, and he had like 10 strikeouts, and 9 of those were looking. And, you know, he said, wow, that's not very good. You know, he's kind of funny about it. But, you know, he said he's got to get the biggest thing about his two-strike approach is just to get to where he's not getting two strikes. So he says he feels better than he's felt in a long time, and he expects to, you know, really bust loose here, you know, any time now. So, you know, and he looks fine swinging the bat. So I would expect to see something from him. And, you know, really the thing before, too, you know, he started the season and he had a hurt left hand as well, which really bothered him, I think, more than he let on. So that's completely healed now. So, you know, a healthy Will Myers means some healthy cuts.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to play what if with anybody after 130 games. Every club has some what ifs, but it seems like there aren't many bigger what ifs than what if the Rays had a healthy Will Myers for the last 4 months and what that could have meant for a team that, you know, is several games out but is pretty close to being pretty good.
Well, that, and I'll throw another one at you. What if they'd had Brad Boxberger all year? You know, a lot of people thought he should have made the club out of spring training, and they were playing that kind of protect Josh Lukey game, and they had, of course, you know, and that didn't turn out well. But, you know, what might have happened had they had him the whole first month of the season? I mean, he's been, you know, lights out of the bullpen. He's right up there with McGee. So those kind of things will drive any baseball manager or general manager crazy.
That's why they hate answering those questions, by the way.
Exactly.
We talked some in the past, in recent weeks, about Evan Longoria, but it's hard not to keep talking about it. He's hitting under 230 for a stretch that's not just a week or two. It's now more than 2 months that he's hitting under 230. Is he healthy?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that. I will be writing some tonight on he's actually playing DH for the second night in a row, and his right forearm's bothering him a little bit, but he insists that it's just on throwing. So, you know, and it's not, you know, he expects to be back in the field tomorrow, but it's just biting him a little bit on his throws. And he says it's not hurting his, you know, hurting his swinging. But, you know, he really has no excuses for it. He's been very open about it. You know, he just maintains, you know, I can't try any harder, but it's just been a bad year.
I mean, it's a little bit like the situation with David Wright. You know, there's this notion around the Mets that they almost hope David Wright is hurt, because if he's hurt, then you understand why he's not hitting. Is there any notion, I mean, you don't hope the guy's hurt in a literal sense, but is there any idea that maybe it would be some relief if somebody found out that the guy's been dealing with some kind of sore ankle or something all year? I mean, it's baffling that a guy that good has that hard a time for that long hitting.
Well, again, he's insisted he's totally healthy, and he's played in every game this year. So it's kind of hard to hang that out there. It might just be he's having a bad year. But, you know, again, this guy is the best bat in their lineup, and he really hasn't had too much protection. And when you don't see a lot of pitches, you know, you're going to start expanding your strike zone sooner or later. Even the best hitters do that. And I think that's probably been his biggest sin this year is, you know, pitchers have been getting him out with pitches outside of the strike zone.
How does a guy adjust that? What does a guy do who's that good and has that good an eye? Just on a micro level, what do you think a guy does to adjust when he's gotten out of his approach?
You know what? I don't think that's one of those things where I think hitters never really know what they're going to do on that, because every time, every funk a hitter goes through is a new calamity. And, you know, I've talked to him about that before about, you know, I said, well, you know, you're so good. I said, you know you're going to come out of this. And he says that never makes it easier. You know, when you go through it, it's like the first time every time. So I imagine he's trying everything possible to work it out, but there's just no, you know, tried and true remedy, bottle of feel good to make it better.
I'm told that hitting is really, really hard. I was never any good at it, so I'm the wrong
one. Yeah, you know, the good ones. Yeah, you know, the good ones get 3 hits out of every 10 at bat.
I have heard that. Let's talk about something positive. Alex Cobb might be the most underrated pitcher in the American League. And he's going really well right now. In his last 8 starts, he's given up 8 runs total. Beyond just simply being really good, what's working for him right now?
Well, he's got that change that really does some funky stuff. But, you know, I think above all else, he's just mentally just a really tough guy. At the same time last year, you know, a lot of us thought that he was better, you know, the top pitcher in the Rays staff, including David Price. And he started the season like that. Of course, he hurt his oblique after pitching 7 scoreless against Cincinnati, and then he was out for a while. And he struggled with his mechanics, but now that he feels like he's got his mechanics back and he's on the mound and not thinking about his mechanics, you know, he can just think about how to attack hitters. And when he does that, he's really good. I mean, he just knows what he's doing out there.
Was it that simple? Was just kind of adjusting to get his delivery back in order, those 6 or 7 starts after he came back when he wasn't quite right?
Yeah, but, you know, it is a struggle because you're out on the mound and you don't want to be thinking about those mechanics. You know, it's tough enough to pitch to a hitter, you know, play the bait and switch game you got going with, you know, cat and mouse with major league hitters. And it's tough enough to do that without having to think, you know, oh, I need to have my knee further over here. And, you know, and in fact, I remember watching him. I was talking to him off to the side one day and, you know, we were talking about how it looked like his, you know, he has that almost pause. It's kind of a lot like what some of the Japanese pitchers do. And it looked like it had grown, gotten even more pronounced. So I think he's kind of reined that in a little bit. But, you know, he's been really tough the last couple times out. I mean, and, you know, what he did against David Price the other day was amazing.
Is he the next candidate for one of those long-term extensions that organization does so often?
You know what? I thought he would have been, you know, I think it was the Escobar deal this year. You know, it was, we went over to the building not knowing who it was, and I was thinking, you know, it might be Cubs' turn. So I'm probably a little bit surprised it hadn't happened yet because he is, you know, to me, he's, you know, a number two knocking on the door of becoming a number one. And I don't, you know, and I really don't, I know myself, I think a lot of the pronouncement of being a number one starter, and, you know, I think it really means a lot. If you are a number one, it says you can do a lot, and I think he's right there.
Do you get the impression that's something they have pursued and it hasn't happened, or is that just something they haven't really made a priority yet?
You know, they're not real good with signals about that. I know, you know, probably they do explore that with most of their guys because that's an effective way to, you know, control guys a little bit longer. You never know if that's one of those deals where Cobb might want to take a risk and go a little bit longer. But, you know, most of these players seem to appreciate the value of making your first fortune before you, you know, cash in a little bit earlier than just waiting for your arbitration eligible. And I would, but like your first original question, I certainly wouldn't be surprised if they came and offered him that kind of deal.
All right, well, thanks, Bill Chastain, for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras, talking Boston Red Sox with MLB.com's Red Sox beat reporter, Ian Brown. Ian, your team has an amazing ability to make big news even when they are in fifth place. This week it was the signing of Rusney Castillo. How did this all come together, and how quickly did it come together for this deal to get done for a team that's clearly been in search of bats and offensive talent?
Yeah, you know, the funny thing, Matthew, is I don't think that many of us knew just how long this was coming together because, you know, the Red Sox painted a picture the other day of a player in Rusney Castillo who they've been watching since 2011, or they've been aware of since 2011 when they first scouted him in Amsterdam, playing in some sort of showcase there, and then they watched him again the next year in another sort of showcase. So they've had their eyes on this guy for a long time, and that they were aware when he first tried to defect and then, you know, was suspended by Cuba and so forth. So they like him a lot. They like his body type. They like, you know, his legs. He's a fast guy. You know, a lot of people were wondering, including me, you know, last year why the Red Sox didn't do more to replace Jacoby Ellsbury, and I think we might be getting our answer right now because I think that this is the guy they had in mind. They didn't see anybody like this in the major league market who could replace Ellsbury's speed, his defense, you know, maybe his bat. And I think that they think that Rusney Castillo has a real chance to bring a lot of the same things that, you know, Jacoby Ellsbury brought to the table there in Boston for a long time.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of different names mentioned when it comes to Castillo. I've heard Brett Gardner. I've heard Ron Gant. And to start with, those are two pretty significantly different players. What kind of player do you think Castillo projects to be once he's got some time in the major leagues?
Yeah, no, I think you get, sort of a Brett Gardner type of numbers, they'd be thrilled. And it's hard for us to really project too much because, look, none of us have seen this guy play except for, a YouTube clip here or there. And, look, the guy hasn't played organized ball in a year and a half now, so there's just not that much out there. So we kind of right now we sort of have to trust what they saw. John Farrell mentioned a smaller body type. At least he mentioned a smaller version of Puig. Probably not the same type of power there by any means. I think more of a leadoff type of player. But a leadoff type of player, a little pop in the bat. They're thinking 10 to 15 home runs a year. Not a great on-base guy. The Red Sox are known for their on-base, but you're not always going to have all nine guys in the lineup trying to get on base all the time. So they think that surrounding him with the other guys in their lineup, they think that he can maybe set the table a little bit for Pedroia and Ortiz and Cespedes and Napoli and Craig. And suddenly what looks like a pretty potent lineup for next year. They've had this anemic lineup this year, and now you look at the offense and you think, maybe that's a strength, going into next year.
Yeah, and that leads me into my next question. In the immediate term, first, what's his short-term future? What are the plans for the next couple of months, maybe for the off-season, any kind of winter ball or instructional? Between now and next spring, what's the organization's plans for him?
Yeah, the first thing they got to do is get this work visa complete. That always takes a few days. Hopefully that's all it takes. Then they'll get him to an affiliate, they hope, because these minor league seasons are starting to shut down around September 1st. At least get him a couple games down there so he can get his legs under him. And then they're hoping to see him in Boston here for at least a couple weeks at the end of the regular season, see what they have, and then evaluate, okay, is this guy rusty from not playing for a long time? Does he kind of need some more bats and winter ball, or would they be better served going another way? It wouldn't surprise me at all to see him play at least some winter ball this year just because he has been sort of out of action for a long time here.
And then what about next year? I mean, is the hope, the expectation that he comes and is basically in the starting lineup opening day 2015?
Yeah, I mean, they look at this guy right now as this is their center fielder kind of going forward. And, there's always, depending on what happens with the rest of the roster, there's always a way that he could end up in right. The way the Red Sox like to put it is in a perfect world, we have two center fielders playing, center and right field, because right field is such a tough position to play at Fenway, and that's where you had a guy like Victorino last year who was a caliber of a center fielder. You had J.D. Drew a few years back who was a really good outfielder. So they really like to have two good outfielders there. So it's just too early to see exactly what the composition of that roster is going to be. Do they move Alan Craig to first base and then try to trade him Mike Napoli? There's just so many kind of permutations right now that you're trying to wrap your head around. You just really have to see kind of how the winter plays out before you really see how this all comes together.
It's an interesting situation because more and more there are fewer places for a really high-revenue club to kind of take advantage of its high revenue, and it seems like this international market is still one area where they can. And the reason I mention that is that there's some notion that he may be a little bit of a high-risk player, that he may not be a hit right off the bat. And we hear about the dollars and people's kind of eyes pop at the dollars, but from the Red Sox perspective, is this – really that big an investment, or do they still think maybe this is even potentially a bargain investment on a relatively unknown player?
Yeah, you make a great point, Matthew. This is a way for the Red Sox to sort of, flex their muscles a little bit, maybe pay a little more for somebody than somebody else would. And they look at the average annual value where it's going to be something like, really $10, $11 million a year. And for the Boston Red Sox, that's not a ton of money. You saw them – you remember when they really want somebody, like when they really want a J.D. Drew, and they pay $14 million a year for him. I mean, not many people would have paid that much for J.D. Drew, but the Red Sox thought they really needed that sort of elite defender in right field at the time. So that's why, they'll overpay in certain spots. And, they don't know exactly what kind of hitter this guy's going to be. If it's not quite a $10 million hitter, I think if it's more of a $7 or $8 million hitter, they're still comfortable, with the money they spend here because they don't see a lot of guys like this coming out on the free agent market. And like I said, going back to when they lost Ellsbury, you know, they didn't see a lot of ways to replace it based on the current pool of players and kind of who's out there right now.
I think you may have just set a record with two mentions of J.D. Drew in the same podcast. We're going to have
to check. I know, yeah. Well, you know, I know you
check with Corey Schwartz in the stats department on that.
I think you're going down on memory lane a little with J.D. We can talk about Steven, too, if you want.
Well, you know, I actually cover J.D. He's one of my favorite guys. I don't know Steven, so there is some seemingly pretty good news around the Red Sox lately in the midst of some tough times. It seems like Clay Buchholz is maybe really getting his stuff together. How does that look to you?
Yeah, you know, he's pitched well three out of the last four starts now. You know, he had kind of a clunker against the Angels before this last start in Toronto where you're kind of like, oh, no, here we go again. What's going on? But, yeah, I mean, this was one of the goals for the end of the season for them to get this guy back on track and start using all his pitches again. And for whatever reason, he had become a little – seemed like cutter happy. You know, he wasn't throwing that changeup like he can really throw it or that curveball. And this guy's a really good pitcher when he's on. He can be an elite pitcher when he's on. So I think that, you know, if they can get him to pitch well throughout September, that would be a huge victory for this team. If they can get him kind of going for next year, because, you know, especially with there's so much uncertainty in their pitching staff right now, that Buchholz is a real, real key for them going into the 15 season.
Has anybody, and I know we talked about this before, but it seems a little puzzling if he gets right and nobody ever really knows exactly what was wrong as he starts turning
well,
the right direction?
I think what happens with Buchholz is that, you know, he's not the strongest guy mentally, you know, to be candid. When things start to go wrong, he starts to internalize a little too much. Things just start to speed up on him a little. You know, they thought he was over this by now because we saw this happen to him, you know, real early in his career. In 2008, he was just a mess. And then it was 2012 coming off the back injury he had the year before that. He was kind of a mess the first couple months of the season. So he's just, you know, you have streak hitters. Well, in this case, you have a real streak pitcher where it seems like to me that this guy is either pitching really, really well or he's just kind of pitching you out of games. And, you know, you're really hoping for that former when he's on one of those really good streaks that you can just kind of ride this guy for a while, but for whatever reason, there has never been a lot of happy medium with Clay Buchholz. You know, it's really been one extreme or the other, so they're really hoping that the extreme can be the one they had the first 3 months of the 2013 season when he was, you know, one of the best pitchers in the American League.
Talk about, you know, the things that this club wants to get sorted out or get right for next year, and one we've talked about recently is the desire to have Alan Craig go into the winter on a good feeling. The numbers in the first few games back off the DL haven't been really good, but, you know, absolutely anything can happen in 15 at-bats. How does his health look to you? How do his at-bats look to you? Does he look like a guy who has a chance to finish the season on a strong note?
I think he does. You know, Alan Craig right now is just trying to find his rhythm. I mean, it's been a really disjointed season for him, from the problems he was having in St. Louis to then just the real kind of stunning trade there. He didn't really see that coming. And then, you know, he kind of tweaks his foot. The first game he's with the Red Sox, then kind of has to slow that down. So I think it's just being out of rhythm. If he can just get into a rhythm of playing time here, and then I think you can start to see what you have. And they really want to make sure that foot is okay. I think there's some line of thinking there, thinking that, you know, St. Louis played so deep in the season last year that if Craig did need to get something done on his foot, surgery-wise, they didn't really have time to do it because the Cardinals did go to the World Series. So I think, you know, by the time this season ends on September 28th, that's an extra month, they're going to get a real good read at that foot, say, hey, does this need even any kind of just a minor maintenance surgery just to make sure this is not an issue at all? So I think, you know, health is another thing with Craig that they want to make sure it's right going into the winter.
Well, everybody, thanks for joining us on Ian and Matthew Talk About Former Card. I mean, thanks for joining us on MLB.com Extras. Ian Brown, thanks for taking a few minutes to talk ball. Thanks, everybody, for listening. This is MLB.com Extras, American League East.